I actually also have a long, almost a decade now, practitioner history. I've worked for a long time in alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs, and interpersonal violence prevention. So I could talk forever about this. This is a tiny snippet of one study. So if you want to talk more after, come find me. Okay, I have no disclosures. And an important note, in this presentation, when I talk to them about the past and current sexual assault research, I'm focusing mostly on the victim or survivor as being female and the perpetrator as being male, but acknowledging that there are other scenarios, and I'm not talking a lot about research related to that. Okay, so as Kate indicated, and thankfully I don't have to spend too much time on it, sexual assault's been in the news. Sexual assault on the college campus has been at the forefront of legislative and political issues, and we have legislation surrounding it. Now everybody's, we're all trying to get our acts together, so to speak. Grateful for this, putting it at the forefront, but it is a rush. So I'm gonna talk a little bit about, I'm gonna talk a lot about victim blaming and just some background. Victim blaming is when we or others place blame on the crime, on a sexual assault, on the victim rather than the perpetrator, or tend to focus on things that the victim or survivor should have done, didn't do, etc., that decreases blame on, or minimizes the event. So why does it occur? Victimization perspective theories state that this occurs so that we can try to alleviate our own helplessness and rationalize why we're not going to be victims. It helps us to keep someone at an arm's length to say, that's not me, that's not going to happen to me, and these are the reasons why. And Jan F. Bowman in 1979 found that there are actually two types of victim blaming, and this happens with self-blame as well as observer blame. There's characterological blame, which is when we blame the character of the person. These are non-modifiable things that they can't change. So being too trusting, too careless, too helpless, too naive, things that we may think of as traditional feminine qualities. And then there's also behavioral victim blaming, which is more control related, things that they could have changed. The behavior of the source is to blame. She got too drunk. She was dressed like a slut. So this is our common slut shaming. She was walking by herself at night. She didn't walk in the well-lit areas. Prior research indicates that observers, so non-victims, tend to engage more in the behavioral blame rather than the characterological blame. And this makes sense, especially when we think of wanting to have control over our environment and saying, well, if you don't do this, you don't do this, you don't do this, then it's not going to happen. I'm not going to do all those things. But recently, we have very little research looking at these two different distinctions and what might be happening currently. So, as a part of a larger study, we were trying to look at the campus climate on our campus related to sexual assault prevention, response, etc., awareness of policies. The purpose was to evaluate the current campus climate with regards to student attitudes toward knowledge of and behaviors surrounding interpersonal violence, with a focus on sexual assault and sexual violence. And we had three specific aims. I'm mostly going to talk today about the second one, which is identifying common sexual assault myths and misperceptions. Quick background, we divided them into five subgroups, male, female, Greek, non-Greek, and then those who would not fit neatly into those four boxes, identity not listed. We had 9 focus groups and 4 individual interviews, and for a total N of 65 people falling all in those subpopulations. Myself and one other a graduate assistant was working with me. We were the two coders, and we had 2 a staff member and another graduate assistant who were the reviewers to make sure that we were on point. So our themes. Let me just say that I have these nice little neat arrows here, but really these arrows should be going all over the place and pointing to each other, and it's hard to really say that one perpetuates the other. But basically, the gist is we found that beliefs and perceptions about sexual violence often depend on the context of the incident. This is really nothing new. When we see sexual assault studies, they often use vignettes or scenarios, and that they found similar things. It depends, is often the response. So the students' perception about whether or not sexual assault actually occurred was based on those little nuances and factors, and assisted them in identifying what sexual assault and what might be regret sex or not quite sexual assault. So what we found generally was that this idea of a hookup culture mentality on college campuses was perpetuating this myth of blurred lines around consent. We heard a lot about there's passive consent, it just sort of happens, there's no real yes or no, so that idea of blurred lines. We also found that this culture of alcohol use perpetuated that idea of regret sex. Well, they just got drunk and then woke up the next morning and realized, well, maybe I shouldn't have done that, I probably shouldn't have done that. And they categorized that as regret sex, not really sexual assault. And then we have this other perpetuating factor of gender role expectations that seem to perpetuate the myths related to victim blaming. And this is what really got my attention, because some things stood out here to me that seemed different than what I had heard, read, or known before. So generally, to going to the victim blaming gender, one of the things we found was that the women appeared to victim blame more often than men. This is actually counter to what previous studies have shown. Previous studies indicate that men actually engage more in victim blaming than women, traditionally. And this is easy to understand when you think about some of those theories, like defense attribution theory. You know, the less like me that you are, the easier it is to blame you. So a man blaming a woman is a lot easier to envision than a woman blaming a man, just based on that theory alone. But this was counter to what we'd heard before. Also, men focused more on behavior blame, which is still consistent with some of the prior research we've seen. And interestingly, not consistent with prior research I've seen, is that women seemed kind of conflicted with behavioral blame. In the past, most women and men tend to engage more in behavioral blame, but the women were conflicted with it, and I'll get to that in a second. And they more easily focused on the characterological blaming. So among men, some examples emphasizing behavioral, one of the quotes, "I'm not going to be going into a lion's cage with a nice T-bone around my neck," in reference to a woman's clothing. You know, put on, and the rest of that quote is, you know, put on a trench coat or something when you're walking on the street. Men also tended to focus on the masculine role. It depends on how much the person teases the other person to the extent that they, the perpetrator, couldn't hold back. What was interesting was the other side of this as well, is that men also focused on this masculine role as being a reason to help in instances that looked like they might be sexual assault. So to help a woman who looked like she maybe have been drinking too much or may be vulnerable, or to help steer a man away from a woman who might be about to take advantage of, lost my train of thought. And I'll go back to that one again too. So the victim blaming among women, I'd mentioned that the women seemed to struggle with the behavioral piece. There was a lot of the, she shouldn't do this, but she should be able to do that. So they had a really hard time with this. And they seemed very tired of behavioral blaming, which if you'll notice, I'm going to read you a quote, and the emphasis is what the students said. It's not my own emphasis. And it sounds very similar to a lot of the risk reduction methods that we use now. Society is always telling girls what to do, and they tell girls to walk on the side of the street that has lights on it and walk with a friend. They tell girls, don't get drunk, do not have fun, ever. Don't wear this, and don't say that, and don't look at that guy that way, and you won't get sexually assaulted. But you could get sexually assaulted no matter what. They recognize this. They recognize these messages that they've been given, and they're saying, but you're not keeping us safe. They also admit that they still catch themselves doing this behavioral blame. I agree that anybody could be a victim, but I think that sometimes it has to do with how the woman dresses, and the more provocative you dress, the more they might get attention. So there was this conflictedness there. So what it seemed that they were doing is reframing and turning some of the behavioral characteristics, I'll show you in the next slide another quote, turning the behavioral characteristics into a characterological quality of the victim that they, the observer, don't have. And we found this overall theme of smart women don't get raped, strong women don't get raped. There was this admonishment of feminine qualities, that you're weak if you get raped, or you're not strong, and you're not smart. Example, so drinking too much, in this quote I'll summarize, she's talking about how drinking can invite good or bad, and it depends on how responsible you are. If you're responsible, you know your limit and you don't drink too much. So this idea of changing this behavioral thing of high intoxication to a character issue of responsibility and intelligence even. So I think there's a lot of personal responsibility attached to it, that line. Also, you have to be strong. Even I, and I'm an informed person, like, cannot get out of my brain that someone who is sexually assaulted is weak. Like, that's just at my very core because I've been taught that for so long. And that's my emphasis on this one, actually. That stood out to me. Again, going back to those risk reduction methods. You should always have a strong response. No, I'm not interested. Victims are the kind of people who don't say anything, and they're quiet and just want them to go away. But they're not really verbal and aggressive about the point. This was also really interesting to me, and I can go on for reasons why, but they've done studies of women and how they, as victims, blame based on whether or not they had a strong response. So that was really interesting. Okay, so who's responsible? The students agree that pretty much everybody. We have to look out for each other. We heard a lot of that. If you see somebody take a pass at a girl and she obviously is pushing him off, then, you know, be a man. Step up. Tell him, hey, especially if he's drinking, it's really easy to get a drunk guy to change his mind and go somewhere else. And this one's really long, but the gist is that this was a female student. Obviously, I feel responsible for my own actions and everything I do, but I feel it's wrong that we have to be protected all the time. And she says, you know, I have to make sure when I go out at night I'm going with girlfriends, or I have at least one male friend, or I have my pepper spray, or I take a self-defense class, or maybe I just shouldn't leave my apartment. And it's just a lot. It's a lot to put on yourself personally, and I think a lot of people need to work on it together because no one person can really have complete control over that. I think it's, as I said before, it's a cultural thing that needs to shift. What do we do? These students are so smart, right? Practical recommendations, continuing education about consent, sex, and the nature of sexual violence. One big caution, though, is that idea of when we're teaching students what getting consent is like and what giving consent is like. And one caution we need to take is that when we're telling students to be adamant with the no, 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 we may be perpetuating that feminine versus non-feminine, that weak versus strong. And getting the idea of teaching all students how to ask for sex and how to show when you want sex and how to read those symbols. So being very careful that we're not perpetuating that just by telling them, you need to say no, you need to say no. Widespread implementation of bystander intervention programs. There is some great research, preliminary, some of it, that indicates that this can work. And one of the things I would suggest is that we need an additional focus on challenging attitudes and actions that support rape culture and gendered norms. So it's not just about intervening in the moment of the sexual assault. It's about intervening when you hear someone use terminology that might support sexual violence. Rape jokes, gender jokes, female, male, and using slang terms that are derogative to any group or identity, not just gender. Improving education for responsible reporters on campus. So what do I mean by responsible reporters? Some probably know what I'm talking about. A responsible reporter on a university or college campus is anyone who is not a confidential person. Confidential people include the counselors and the advocates. Those are people who do not have to tell anyone anything, and they're protected by HIPAA and FERPA. As a faculty member, I teach an emotional health class, and I tell my students, if you tell me you have been the victim of any kind of crime, it is my job as a responsible reporter to call up our UPD and say, I have a student who said this crime happened to them in this location around this time. I don't have to give them any of their details, any of their names, but that's what the CLEARI Act is. That's what it's telling us we have to do. So faculty and staff, hopefully, are understanding that they are responsible reporters, but they may not necessarily understand some of the other pieces that go with that. So responding in a non-judgmental way, knowing where the resources are and how to give them to the students. We need to move beyond just the students and campus officials, which is what Campus Save and Not Alone and CLEARI talk about, and start talking to our responsible reporters. We need to enhance education that distinguishes the difference between risk reduction and prevention. Our students are smart, and they get that the stuff we've been telling them is not going to definitely make it not happen. It's not going to definitely stop it. But we need to help them understand that, too, that you can do these things, and that's great, but the most important thing you can do is look out for each other and help each other. And then last, we need more research. We need to have a better idea of what's going on.